Good morning, friends, and you are indeed listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide, and I'm delighted to have a guest today, somebody I've known indeed for half a century, give or take. His name is Ted Smith. He was born and raised in County Westmeath, Ireland. He earned a BA in History and Political Science from Trinity College Dublin and a Master's in Irish Studies from New York University. He served as an Irish diplomat from 1972 to 1988 in Portugal, Geneva, the U.S., and the United Kingdom in a career highlighted by his work on the Northern Ireland peace process. And I could keep reading off his bio of friends, and then we wouldn't have time. But let me tell you, he is and has been a great friend of ours, of the Irish community, both sides of the Atlantic. And no more than myself. There are many who say isn't he retired yet, and believe me, he's not. And to add insult to injury here, friends, we had to go to California to catch up with Ted Smith, who is visiting his family in California. How are you doing there, Ted?
Doing great. I'm visiting my daughter and my granddaughter, Raya, and I wish they weren't so far away. You know, America's a big country. If you're living in Dublin and your daughter is in Galway, it doesn't seem so far away. But that's one of the only downside is the tyranny of distance. I wish all my granddaughters lived around the corner. But, you know, that's life for a lot of people.
That's life. Now, indeed, Ted mentioned there that you were born, bred and buttered in County Westmeath. What part of Westmeath?
Well, it was... first of all, it's a pleasure to be on your show, Adrian. I waited 50 years to get on the show. You've always turned me down before now, so finally made it.
Thank you.
The great age of 73. But you've done so much for the Irish community. You've been the voice of the Irish and really great person. And you're the sort of radio equivalent of Inspector Columbo. You've got that sort of laconic style which lulls everybody into relaxation, and then you get them to say the most extraordinary things, which is just an amazing gift you have, and it brings so many fresh insights and a lot of pleasure to people.
I was going to say, Ted, you know, I'm still trying to get the hang of this thing, you know. 53 years might seem like a long time to, be serving your time in any industry. I tell you, fair play now. We are getting most of the kinks out of it. I want to ask you about
Westmeath. Yes, we'll come back. Yeah, Westmeath. Well, it confuses all the immigration people who ask me where I was born. And I said, I was born in Street House Street, County Westmeath. And they said, yeah, but what street and what number and, you know, what town, for God's sake? And I point out the street is a village in its own right. And we lived in a house called Street House. I was born there. So my father was a farmer. My mother did all this stuff, apart from raising three children that all farmers' wives do. And we did all the mucking out and so forth. So it was an idyllic youth in many respects. Growing up there with my sister and my brother. And, we really had a great upbringing, a great childhood, and I'm very grateful for that. And then it was rudely interrupted by being sent off to boarding school, which I survived, and then escaped to Trinity College, where life opened up for me in a much, very interesting way.
A question... that I'm sure, a lot of people would cross their minds, and mine too, is what led you to a career or in you know, a diplomatic career in foreign affairs in the government of Ireland?
That's a very good question. I was very lucky and privileged to be accepted into the Department of Foreign Affairs. But what led me, I guess, was a great interest in politics and in political leadership. At boarding school, I became fascinated with Daniel O'Connell because one of his descendants, Maurice O'Connell, was my history teacher. And he really imbued in me not just a love of history, but also the sense that one can influence the flow of history, of events, by being very committed to policy and to influencing people, and that it wasn't always hopeless. Because if you're, you know, Daniel O'Connell was extraordinary, the liberator. You know, in my view, Daniel O'Connell, probably Charles Stewart Parnell and John Hume are, you know, up there as the three great Irish people. And we could talk about great Irish women as well, who would be up there as well. But yes, so that was the start of it. And then in Trinity College, I think I graduated in politics rather than my study was history and political science, but most of my time was spent in an organization called the College Historical Society, the HIST, where we had very vigorous debates and we brought in outsiders to speak. It's the oldest debating society in the world. And, you know, goes back to people like Wolf Tone and Edmund Burke, Isaac Butt, a lot of great Irish people. Unfortunately, men, because it was only when I was there in 1971 that we finally admitted women, long overdue. And since then, we've had wonderful, you know, very strong women leaders. But, the world changed, and rightly so. That time. But yes, I was very interested. And another person who influenced me was Freddie Boland, who was the head of our HIST, the president of the HIST. And he had had a brilliant diplomatic career, president of the UN General Assembly, and a renowned figure. And that really made me think. And then the Northern Ireland Troubles were breaking out. We were about to join the European Union. It felt like a time when one could have an impact on some great matters that would affect the future of Ireland and set a new future for us. So I did the exams and very luckily got accepted. In fact, 50 years ago this month, three people entered on the same day. With me were Anne Anderson, who was the former ambassador to the United States and to the UN. She was, in fact, the first female one. And Brian Nason was the other. And in fact, Brian's wife is now the ambassador to the United States, Geraldine Byrne Nason. And
wow.
She hosted a lovely dinner for us a few weeks ago at the embassy to celebrate the 50 years with our respective spouses. And that was just a, you know, walk down memory lane. We told a lot of yarns, some of them true, and had a great time.
I want to ask you about that period, and particularly Northern Ireland, and this was, you know, you got in there at a time when the Troubles were just as we know them, the Troubles were beginning. Were the talks about entering the European Union, were they to the forefront, or was the Northern Ireland unrest was in which order would you say most most people in the island of Ireland, at least, were...
We were obviously very concerned in that year of 72 when I was finishing up at Trinity. We had Bloody Sunday in January of that year, and we adjourned our meeting of the HIST in protest about and in memory of the victims. In fact, I was on the march to the British Embassy when it was burned down, and it acted as a sort of a pressure valve release for the Irish people, who just were so angry and so in despair about what was happening. And in fact, you know, so that was on my mind, and I didn't join until November of that year. The negotiations to join the EU were already completed. In fact, we joined on the formally on the 1st of January. So it was, you know, they were related, the two events, because one of the great hopes of joining the EU, and it has been fulfilled, is that we would have our relationship with Britain, which was always fraught because we were the smaller neighbor, would somehow or other be subsumed within a larger entity called Europe. And that really worked very well until Brexit a few years ago. But our only other ally up to then was the United States. And actually, it's quite interesting. I just I spoke last week in Dublin at a conference called Bridging the Atlantic, with some lot of Americans and Europeans came together. And they wrote, the idea was that Ireland would act as a bridge between the two continents, English-speaking and connected, and very friendly with both sides. And speaking, you know, it's clear from the British papers that have now come to light in 1972 that the U.S. Senate hearings chaired by Ted Kennedy and Senator Abricoff, Ted Kennedy, but also which were initiated by your uncle, Paul O'Dwyer, that these propelled the British government to end the one-sided government instalment and replace it with power sharing in the Sunningdale Agreement. Now, that didn't last, but it was a hopeful sign in that it was power sharing, there was a Council of Ireland and so forth. But so then, you know, we were set back. And by the time I came out to the United States as press officer in 1976, and that's when I first met you. And at that time, President Carter had been elected, and a year later, he called for a just solution in Northern Ireland, involving the support of the Irish government. And people forget he was the first American president to do so. Never been before. They had always recognized that Northern Ireland was a position only of the British government, a domestic issue, and they shouldn't intervene. So Jimmy Carter broke that tradition. And that was the beginning of a very positive and constructive role to be played by Irish Americans and by American presidents in Congress in bringing peace to Ireland.
You know, Ted, in coming to New York at that period, the Irish community, particularly a broad segment of the Irish community, which were very active and concerned about the situation in Northern Ireland, and indeed, you know, when I came from Ireland myself in 1959, I had a bit of shock value because I did not realize in leaving Ireland that, in fact, you know, and being from Mayo, being from the west of Ireland, didn't realize that actually there was any severe trouble, as it became known afterwards, in Northern Ireland. And within, you know, a week in New York, I said, how the hell did I grow up in Ireland and really not be aware, perhaps, but not have any idea of the Irish American influence and the strong support coming from Irish America, whatever that was or wasn't. Here was America agog, Irish America, wanting to see, having more than a passing interest in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and a very, very important interest. I mean, you go back to 1916, Joe Lee, the professor of history, always said, without Irish America, there would be no 1916. And going right up, you know, to modern times. The Americans have come through for us in supporting us. Now, you know, John Hume was one of the early people from civil rights people from Northern Ireland who realized that you could channel that support into putting pressure on the British government. Because we have this asymmetrical relationship with Britain. You know, we can protest in Dublin and say, London, you got to do this and you got to do that. And they ignored us. And it was extremely frustrating to people. Some people felt the only alternative was violence. I always felt that we had to work through this with support from our allies abroad, such as the U.S. government, and bring that pressure to bear in a way that would be recognize the equal rights of nationalists and loyalists in Northern Ireland. And so it was that the Anglo-Irish Agreement, which was being negotiated in 1985, which for the first time gave Dublin a role in Belfast with an actual mm-hmm. office there, was being negotiated. At the last minute, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was refusing to sign it. And we brought this to the attention of Speaker Tip O'Neill and to Senator Kennedy. And Tip O'Neill went to President Reagan and said to him, you've got to get her to sign this. And, of course, Reagan had a close relationship with Thatcher. Mm-hmm. He did lean on her, and she did sign it afterwards. She sort of said, the Americans made me sign it. But it was another breakthrough, and it was actually, without the Anglo-Irish Agreement, we wouldn't have the momentum to move towards the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. And, of course, in that one, again, as we all know, President Clinton and his envoy, Senator Mitchell, played a crucial role in the negotiation and getting it over the line. You know, he was calling every day and every night to make it go forward and had that sort of force and power to make a difference. And that's extraordinary, Adrian, you know. It's to have the American president on the phone in that negotiation, telling both sides, the loyalists and the nationalists and the British, you know, America would stand by this agreement and would make it work and would ensure equality and respect for both traditions and the loyalties and so forth. Very important.
Yeah. I think that some of us, at least anyway, might think that that was the crescendo of Irish-American, that the party was on. Everything was wonderful. And a great number of those who wanted nothing but the best for Northern Ireland, the laying down of arms, you know, a negotiation that had teeth in it, felt that was it. Immediately after that, if not immediately, sometime after that, Irish America, the very same Irish Americans who were very very influential and powerful and had that mettle kind of spirit, found themselves with, you know, job done, okay, next case. And I think perhaps at that time we contributed to that by saying, okay, well, see what we can do, and now, you know, let's get on with it, and all is hunky-dory. And obviously, in the 25 years, whereas, you know, if you take us from, say, Good Friday period, you know, onward, you know, what is the general, and particularly, you know, Irish governments have, you know, there have been a lot of changes through the years, but one would have to say that now coming up to the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, we tend to, you know, it's much easier to accept the fact of what went right over the last 25 years and some of the outstanding issues, the thorny issues. What do you think the oncoming, the visit, the proposed visit of President Joe Biden and of President Clinton, that will something similar come? Will there be, you know, is there a hope that nothing will happen between now and then, or is it? And you are, of course, and have been, you know, the advisory board and Irish Americans for Biden. And what do you think will happen? Will you just come back from right. Dublin and the bridging? What are we waiting for? Obviously, you know, we're looking at you know, a great amount of, you know, agita of sure. of you know, with something that we have, you know, a very powerful ancient order of Hibernians. And it seems like everybody, or most people who have an interest in saying, wait a minute, why are we talking about the success of Clinton, of the, you know, the changing point of having an envoy, very lucky, you know, in Senator George Mitchell? What's that hold up?
Sure, no, it's a good point. I'm on the committee, the ad hoc committee to protect the Good Friday Agreement, and we've been actively lobbying on this subject for some time, particularly since Brexit, when it became clear that there was a threat of a new hard border in Ireland, which would put us totally into reverse from where we were meant to be. And it's true, I mean, the big achievement of the Good Friday Agreement was the, you know, people stopped killing each other, and that's remained in place is not to be underestimated as an achievement. Yes, there are still massive divisions. There are the so-called peace walls all over Belfast. And, you know, we're still waiting for a Bill of Rights. We're still waiting for Irish language rights. We haven't had the power-sharing assembly sitting in place for some time. So there's a lot to be done. And then there's this nonsense, frankly, over the Northern Ireland Protocol. I would hope that the new British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, will devote himself in December, after he's dealt with his own economic issues, to a deal with Brussels, which puts that in the rear view mirror. And there is a landing zone. Simon Coveney has talked about it, Micheál Martin. It's not such a big problem with good political will to solve that one, and then to get the power-sharing government up again in Northern Ireland, and to get these other things done that need to be done. I would hope we'll see some progress on that, frankly, before you know, Good Friday next year. And you know, President Clinton, we're very lucky to have, you know, he's the most Irish president, not just in terms of emotionally, but politically, we've ever had. And at our conference in Dublin, Amanda Sloat, who is his White House representative on Europe and Northern Ireland, you know, she reiterated again that he's 100% supportive of the negotiated agreement that guarantees the integrity of the Good Friday Agreement. And he's spoken, she said, to all three British prime ministers that have gone through recently and made it quite clear that there will be no trade agreement between the U.S. and the U.K. If this thing isn't sorted out. We also had a Republican, two congresspeople, one from the Republican Party, one from the Democratic Party, Ryan Fitzpatrick and Bill Keenan, who were adamant in collectively bipartisan way that there would have to be protection of the Good Friday Agreement. And even if they, you know, and probably will happen that the House will change leadership, and Kevin McCarthy's great-grandfather came from Cork, will take over as Speaker. You know, Brian Fitzpatrick guarantees that the Republican Party will follow the same principles. And as you know, we have, mm-hmm. you know, the Irish American community is probably pretty well split between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. We need to find out more data on that. So, yes, there's more to be done. It's a peace is an ongoing challenge. We can't ever rest on this one. Irish Americans have become very anxious and very involved in it, rightly so. And we need to make more progress. And we're pointing this out to everyone. We can't be going backwards on this. And then, hanging over all of this, I know your next question would be, well, what about, a referendum on United Ireland? And I recommend to all the listeners Professor Brendan O'Leary's recent book on this subject. It's really a handbook on the subject. I reviewed it for Irish Central. And sets out a number of options. And it says, this is the elephant in the room. We can't just ignore it. Within 10 years, there'll probably be a referendum now that there's clearly going to be a majority of nationalists, certainly, Catholics in name, if not always in practice, in Northern Ireland, and for this to be tested. And it could be a fascinating educational exercise, because Brendan says, we can't just have a vote for a vote. We don't know what we're going to vote for. We'll have to have lots of citizens engaged in the process, North and South, because the referendum would be North and South, to discuss what it is we're planning to do, what we're proposing in a referendum. What sort of United Ireland, agreed Ireland, will it be? Because the last thing we want is, just to end up with, violence coming back into the community again.
Yeah.
But so it's a fascinating
question. Which unfortunately, we saw the other night there as well, where a bomb was planted in Northern Ireland in Tyrone, but in the of the whole issue of Ireland and Ireland and the numerous problems that there are in Ireland, obviously, we have Brexit, we have the lack of an assembly in Northern Ireland, we have the whole issue of, what's coming down the road in a unified island of Ireland. I would like you to say, where do we fit into all of this? Irish American, when in fact we're having plenty of our own, political, division here. And there was a time, when it was assumed that if you came from Ireland, that you would be a Democrat because Democrats took care of the working class. But now we're looking at an America that, again, I don't know what the split is, but it should be about, even number of Irish Americans as Democrats and Republicans. So it seems like there is enough stew in the pot here that this might be a good time to pay attention and not wait for, disasters to pile up one after the other.
Yeah, well, I think the midterm results were heartening for anybody who wasn't an extremist. I mean, lots of Republican friends who were heartened that the election deniers were basically put aside by the American people. So that was reassuring, number one. Republicans and Democrats were agreed in the main that we needed to, preserve democracy and speak the truth and not live in some alternative universe of lies and deceit. And that was a great step forward. The other great thing is, I think, Irish studies in America and Irish American studies are essential to keep the Irish community together and engaged. The parishes have broken up largely. Catholic mm-hmm. Church has got a great growth spurt with Hispanics, not so Irish in its leadership, judging by the recent elections to the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference. So it's a time when organizations like Luxman Ireland House and Notre Dame, higher studies there in Boston, and around the country need to sustain the next generation of interest in Ireland and Irish America, because that's the basis for our power in Washington. The feeling that there are, you know, if you have an Irish American name, people will, and you share Irish American values of hard work and honesty, that these and family, that these virtues are considered valuable, and people will vote for them. I think that's going to be very important as we go forward. And I'm honored to be associated with Loretta Luxman, who did a beautiful interview with you here. And it's clear to me that both music and poetry and literature and history are the gateway for more engagement by young Americans in their Irish American heritage, or indeed in choosing to have an affinity with Irish America. You know, we had a great discussion on that last week with Colleen Parsons from Georgetown, Miriam Nine Gray, of course, who is a star in your program here, talking about how we would re-engage Irish Americans in their heritage, so that we don't lose this extraordinary voice we have in this country. I mean, millions of people are engaged. And, you know, Neil O'Dowd and I have often talked about who are the next generation of philanthropists who will do what, Loretta and Bill Flynn and Chuck Feeney and Don Shrew, these people have done. We need these people to be standing up and supporting Irish organizations, institutions. The Irish government is doing its part with the Immigrant Support Program. Irish Tourist Board, of course, is great at bringing, encouraging people to go to Ireland, because we all believe if you go to Ireland, you'll have a great involvement. And then Irish for Biden, which your cousin, of course, Brian O'Dwyer, main organizer of, was terrific. In fact, there was a bias there towards Mayo with former U.S. Ambassador Darling Kevin O'Malley, also there, but Stella O'Leary, all these people you know very well, Neil O'Dowd himself, Ryan McLean, a great friend of President Biden.
There had to be, it must have been important. Okay. I'm sorry, I cut you off there because I wanted to get
that's
past.
That's all right. No. So I think your question is, I think we'll build up Irish America. This is, you know, this is going to be the best help for Ireland, both in terms of peace, investment, and trade and culture. So we've got a lot to do, and it's going to be great fun.
I do want to ask you about having, when you came to the United States, and you became senior executive of a couple of Fortune 500 companies. How, or was there something you brought from your political life and your political experience that was either helpful or in some way, influential in terms of your extraordinary successes, you know, in as executive and senior executive, you know, in business, where you spent another 20 years.
That's very nice of you to say so. I think I was lucky in my life to have great experiences and great insights. But it's hard in a sense to recognize what it is, but the same skills you need in diplomacy and in politics apply in business. You know, you have to have a great human insight. You have to be able to build teams. You have to be able to lead them. I remember once when I got promoted to chief administrative officer, the CEO said to me, you know, Ted, you'll no longer be doing the work. You'll be managing the people who do the work, which I know is everybody's dream. But actually, you have to give up being close to the action and stand back a bit. And your main job then is choosing the right people to put on the bus, and then they get on with it. So it's a lot about recognizing who would work well in any slot. It's all about fit. Everybody's a different form of intelligence. So you need a lot of emotional intelligence, which, you know, we gain in the diplomatic world, because a lot of what we don't have gunships to send in, you know, from Ireland to sink anybody who disagrees with us. We have to use our native-born skills, such that you have, and to get our view across. So I think being from a small country, the diplomatic service gives one a lot more training in the persuasion skills and in understanding, you know, how it is you get a big organization, a global organization, to pull together, to be united, and indeed how you get consumers to, you know, like your product at a very basic level. Mm-hmm. What is it that, how do you serve the customer? How do you serve your investor? You have all these audiences. How do you look after workers? So it's a multiple, you know, four-ring circus, which I find extremely fascinating, and in many ways a continuation of what I was doing in Irish diplomacy.
The bridging the Atlantic, Ireland and the U.S., now that took place at the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin. Who are you? I know you play a key role in that, but
the hosts are. I think it was 4 years ago. I was talking to Dan Mulhall, then the Irish ambassador to the United States, and I said, we really don't have something like the British Irish Association here. We need an annual conference devoted to U.S.-Ireland-Europe relations. And so we got three universities engaged in it, Georgetown University with Pauline Parsons and Professor Catherine C., and then the Queen's University, Belfast, with Katie Hayward particularly, and then the Clinton Institute for American Studies in UCD became the other part of it, and that was with Liam Kennedy. So between the three universities and the Irish Embassy and then the Department of Foreign Affairs, we've had four conferences, and every year we focus on matters of extreme existential importance to the two continents and Ireland's role as a bridge between them. With the withdrawal of Britain from the European Union, we are now the English-speaking, as it were, interlocutor between the two continents. And we bring, you know, it goes back to the concept of an Irish politician once said, you know, Ireland would have to choose which economic role model it wants. Is it going to be Boston or Berlin? And our response was, you don't have to choose. It can be Boston and Berlin. We should look both ways. And we should be able to forge greater unity and alliances between these two great democratic units. They shouldn't be fighting. And that's, you know, ongoing, because there are always great threats of trade wars and so forth. But with Russians attacking, you know, parts of Europe, and with threats from China and so forth, it's really important that the United States and the European Union stand together and don't have, you know, dangerous disputes of difference.
And how do you see Ireland fitting into that? Is Ireland so aligned with the European Union that automatically Ireland and the United States, that benefits all?
Oh, yes. I mean, but Ireland has amazing government leaders and diplomatic service. If you think of the relationship that Micheál Martin and Simon Coveney have, the respect they have in all the European countries, and then the respect in the United States, and the relationships built up by Irish diplomats, we're liked and respected in Europe and in the United States. Maybe it's just our nature. People like you, Adrian, who just have a friendly and open mind, and you know, it's maybe a bit of a generalization and a stereotype, but the Irish, you know, are a very open and generous and friendly people, and that stands to us in terms of finding ways in which we can all get together and support each other, and you know, unity through strength in the Arctic Coral Care. So that's I don't want to overstay this and overdo it, but I think it's nevertheless a role that Global Ireland is playing and can continue to play.
You know, you had mentioned there, you know, you and Brian O'Dwyer and Ambassador, you know, Kevin O'Malley, Neil O'Dowd, John Fitzpatrick, Stella O'Leary, Brian McGinty, Kieran McLaughlin. You had mentioned there that there was somewhat of I thought you gave kind of, you skirted a little bit, you know, in, you kind of threw in Mayo there as, you know, kind of throwaway line. You do know, of course, and if you don't, our listeners know, that, you know, that, you know, President Joe Biden, being from Ballina and County Mayo, sometimes, you know, he can be an embarrassment to some of us, you know, I mean, and we have to defend even why, you know, with your group there, and indeed President Biden, it would be nice if he'd get on the stick, so to speak, and get an envoy over there, because, you know, when you guys come knocking on our door again in another couple of years, we're going to say, well, wait a minute, what was he sitting around for? What was he sitting around, you know, without giving at least what was the proven big plus that Clinton, you know, President Clinton did. So,
sure.
I mean, I don't know. I'm taking a look at the list of the members there, and far be it for me to embarrass any of you, including, of course, Brian O'Dwyer, but we'll expect something to happen there sooner rather than later, hopefully.
Well, I hope so. In earlier this year, I wrote a piece with Ambassador Susan Elliott, who is a former U.S. diplomat, and Bonnie Weir from Yale, calling for President Biden to appoint an envoy. The Irish government is in favor of it also. It would be helpful in terms of helping to move the situation along. We've always been told that there is a favorable wind blowing towards that. So, yes, let's hope it happens before the Good Friday Agreement comes around again in April. I think it's a very good point. An envoy can only be helpful. And, you know, some of the names you mentioned, including Brian, would be extremely helpful and influential in this regard. And, you know, somebody who's known to be speaking with the support of the president, and as the way, you know, most of these envoys have. You know, even President Trump appointed Mick Mulvaney to the job, and I'm told he did a conscientious, good job over there. So there's, you know, a lot to be said on that subject, and you know, I'm glad you raised it, and it's something that should happen.
And of course, we've had the benefit now of having, you know, Bill Kennedy, Congressman Bill Kennedy, who's been, you know, returned as Congress in this election. His visit to both Dublin and Belfast to have a congressional group, a congressional-led group there at this time, and to have, again, Bill Kennedy, you know, coming back and saying, absolutely, yes, convinced that that's something that the president should get on and pretty soon. So hopefully that will happen again soon. Finally, Ted Smith, I want to ask you about the effect of Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol. Are they attached at the hip? And again, is America, Irish America, have any role in trying to move that forward, or like most people that, you know, that are standing back from and say, listen, let them figure it out themselves. What is your view on
I think absolutely Irish America should step forward. The Ancient Order of Hibernians is very active in the ad hoc committee to protect the Good Friday Agreement and its integrity. Irish organizations should please speak up on this subject. It's one of crucial importance. We went backwards with Brexit because suddenly in Northern Ireland, the English nationalists were saying, well, you've got to decide if you're, you know, British or if you're Irish. And up to then, a lot of people were saying, well, I'm European. I could be a nationalist, but I'm also European. I'm a loyalist and I'm European. So for a moment, that umbrella went away. But, you know, as part of the protocol, farmers and business people in Northern Ireland are going to have unique access to both the British market and to the European market, something which no other part of Europe has, which, if it can be sorted out in the protocol, will lead to massive investment and prosperity in that part of the world and will be a real shot in the arm. So everybody, you know, everybody should be supporting that outcome of the protocol. And Irish America, yes, must get behind it, must support it. And you know, as I said, British governments have been very influenced by America in the past, and the force of Irish American opinion reinforced by Congress and by the president. So, you know, Kevin McCarthy hopefully will hear that from the Irish communities. Irish Republicans need to speak up. Irish American Republicans and the Republican Party, that is, need to speak up and let him know, as Speaker, he needs to do what Nancy Pelosi did, lead a delegation to go to Ireland, as she did in 2019, and say we're rock solid behind the Good Friday Agreement and behind equal rights for nationalists and unions, for Bill of Rights, Irish language rights. You know, we've got to get on with it. The Good Friday Agreement hasn't been properly implemented yet and needs to be right away. So, yes, I hope that answers your question.
Surely does. And, you know, we were all ready to sit back, and here you are now leaving us with a big job to do. Ted Smith, you're more than welcome. And again, the next person who said, you know, or who suggested perhaps, you know, you withered away into retirement. Well, you know, something. We'll give them your number because. Thanks a lot, and thanks for taking time out from your own family in sunny California.
It's a great pleasure to talk to a legend like you, and you and Anya, you know, big admirers, and thank you very much. Garamila Mahagut, and hope to talk to you again soon.
And Garamila Mahagut again, thank you very much. Ted Smith and friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com, worldwide.